Thanks for listening to Bookworm. I'll bet you'll want to listen to DNA, KCRW's podcast with Frances Anderton. She's really one of the best informed people about architecture and the face the world is putting on today. Find DNA on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without good old Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today it's a pleasure to see Martin Amis again and to talk about his book, The Zone of Interest. Once again, as in Time's Arrow, he's visiting a German concentration camp. That was a sweet book, by comparison.
Well, Time's Arrow.
Yes.
Well, doing it backwards in time, of course, completely transforms the morality of it. So the Holocaust becomes a kind of a rather ugly and unhygienic miracle, where you summon a race from the clouds and then you return them to their villages and towns, and it's as if you've created a whole people. Because the arrow of time is, funnily enough, the arrow of morality in 100% of cases.
Yeah, suddenly in that book, people came back to life, and it was, in a way, a miracle book. This book takes the difficulty that people had with Hannah Arendt's banalization of evil several steps further to the banalization of life itself. The concentration camp is a place where people are going to work. They're discussing things that in context become horrible. Did you get laid last night? Did you see that pretty girl? Well, put that in the concentration camp, and suddenly our blood is chilled. It's as if life should, by rights, suspend itself there. And that, what did we want? Nobility? And so how was this to write?
Yes, you're right. In the germ of it, subconsciously, was that to learn that they had their wives and children there, and not everyone, but senior SS officers. The commandant had five children there. And why would they bring their... It's to have a sort of varnish of normality while these unspeakable events are going on. And for the commandant, who's one of the narrators of this book, it's for him a logistical problem. And he's hectored by Berlin, by various agencies in Berlin, and he looks at it that way. He doesn't consider the morality of it for a second. But how was it to write? It was, I can't claim that it was difficult and agonizing, although there were crises. But it seemed that, I wrote that first novel about the Holocaust nearly 25 years ago and have been reading about it ever since. And I think I'd done the emotional work spread out over time. And when I came to this, I found that I had my initial idea, which was a sort of love at first sight moment in this bizarrely repulsive setting. And then when I began to write, as sometimes happens, and it's a wonderful thing for the writer, it all seems to be there already.
It's the nephew of Martin Bormann, who's working in the industrial sector.
With a huge IG Farben venture that cost 30,000 lives, slave lives.
Attempts to make artificial rubber and artificial carbide.
Fuel, yes.
Yes. And he falls in love with the wife of Paul Dahl, the commandant, whose name is Hannah. And now, get me out of my pit here. She seems horrible.
Who, Hannah?
Yes.
Well, no, I mean, she reveals herself as being 100% alienated from the Nazi regime. You meet at the dinner party when she says that the Jews are always trickers. Really, that's accusatory, because it exactly describes what the Germans are doing to the Jews. They deceive them, and then they rob them of everything they had, including their hair, the gold in their teeth, and their bones ground for fertilizer. So they are the... And it was also, and I didn't understand this some time ago, but it was an incredibly rapacious venture, the Holocaust. It was meant to be self-financing. I mean, did you know that many of the evacuees paid their own fare to Auschwitz?
I learned it in your book.
Yeah, yeah. And they thought, you know, they'll strip the Jews of all their possessions. They'll Aryanize their businesses. And this will be, you know, an earner. It will make money rather than cost money. In fact, the opposite was the case, and it used up a great deal of resources and man hours and fuel hours and police hours. There were thousands of camps, and it was contributing nothing at all to the war effort, on the contrary. And they were also wantonly killing what they would eventually need, which was their labor. And they reproached themselves for having killed 3 1/3 million Russian POWs, because suddenly they realized they didn't have anyone to do the work. And by the end of the Third Reich, there were 10 million laborers in Germany extracted from the conquered territories.
We're visiting the nightmare of practicality in this novel, The Zone of Interest by Martin Amis, that even if we were not talking about one of the horrific crimes of humankind in living memory, would be awful anyway. We are discovering, yes, that we do not have the equipment to send our own American soldiers, to give them enough warm clothing as they go to Afghanistan. You know, there's a terrible recognition here that war is a tax on available equipment, and that a country in a bereft economy cannot afford to wage war. Another one of these terrible death skull grins that occurs in the Zone of Interest.
Yeah, I mean, it still troubles me whether, in fact, something quite supernatural happened in Germany, the most educated nation that ever been, then undertaking this amazingly assiduous and pedantic exploration of baseness. We're familiar of times in history when the value of human life collapsed, as after the Russian Revolution and then under Stalin, life was worth nothing. But something more extreme happened, more radical happened in Germany. It almost became, at one point, a character says they have this Aztec hunger for death. I don't believe in evil as a sort of detached force. Anthony Burgess, the novelist, said, who's a Catholic, said to me that there's no utilitarian explanation for what happened in Eastern Europe, 1941, 1945, that evil appeared and got going. I think it was just death that appeared and got going, and seemed to gather its own momentum.
I'm talking to Martin Amis about his book, The Zone of Interest. And in your afterwards, you quote the famous section of Primo Levi's memoir in which he recalls reaching out of the train window to grab an icicle.
Which he's got a four-day thirst.
It's taken from him. He says, why? And the guard says, there is no why in Auschwitz.
Yes, well, yes, here there is no why. Yeah. And that applies to the larger picture, too. It was, as well as being as evil as the human being, setting the terminal point of human evil doing, it was also preposterous and contemptible in that way, and stupid.
Now, why a novel?
Well, you know, novels start not with a decision, but with a shiver, a shudder in the loins, and then you think, this is a piece of fiction I can write. May only be a short story, maybe a novella, maybe a novel, short novel, maybe a full-size novel. So I just, you get that shiver, and it's usually to do with an image or a character or a situation, and it's a really distinct feeling where you think, here comes something I can write. And I just responded to that, thinking it was going to be a short story, and then it just seemed to be there, and I, you know, thought it was mine to write, and I'll write it.
The horrible thing for me growing up a Jewish child in a house, by and large, without books, except the popular books about the Third Reich at the time, and to find myself reading those books and being horrified to the point of stimulation by them. The terrible thing about horror, whether it's to be found in Sod or in a description of daily camp life, is that it seems like an act of malignant imagination, but imagination nonetheless, like Hansel and Gretel, that we are drawn to it almost because of its unbelievability. Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, when I said it was not agonizing to write, the strangest episodes in the writing of it were when I was putting myself into the mind of Paul Doll, the commandant, particularly in his treatment of that gypsy girl, Alice Sicer, towards the end. And I'd think, well, what he's doing is very evil. And I'd look into myself and think, but can you think of something more evil? And I would go into a kind of trance and shock myself, scandalize myself by coming up with something more evil. And this sort of ties in with the experience of those who were there, in that both perpetrators and victims, all the survivors' testimonies have one theme that they stress, which is no one knows themselves. That you don't know what your potentialities are for evil or for resilience. So I undertook that, and I found that there were pockets of evil imagination in me, and it was a very depersonalizing process.
Well, you use as an epigraph the witch's recipe in Macbeth, and it is both scary and beautiful to hear all of the horrible things you can toss into a cauldron on the way to creating an evil spell. And I think that's one of the paradoxes of the dark imagination, that there is no limit to what can be imagined, and we feel there should be a limit to what can be enacted.
Yes, and what can be written. I mean, there is a school of thought that says that under the inscription on the gates of Auschwitz, Arbeit macht frei, there should be another one saying, poets and novelists not welcome.
Yes.
Forbidden entry. rather like saying Jews not welcome, you know, but poets and novelists. And some very respectable people think that, but it makes no philosophical, it's a philosophical non-starter, surely. I mean, at what point does something become so terrible that you can't write fiction about it? And what if, say, you know, God forbid, ISIS, Islamic State, suddenly got going on a really vast scale? And when does the gate come down that you can't write about it? The larger principle is that fiction is freedom, and freedom is indivisible. So there's nowhere that you're forbidden from going.
It's a book that really did manage to get to me. It gave me the willies. They say in the book, an intake is going well. The guests are being welcomed to their healthful environment. They will be disinfected, yes, because we have no diseases here and we don't want any.
Yes.
And then a lorry drives by with bodies dangling over the edge, and one of the higher-ups says they won't notice, they won't be able to register what they're seeing. And that, too, is one of the effects of this book on a reader, that the horror becomes so distinct and yet so brilliantly rendered that we continue reading because of our admiration for the author, for the act of writing. And somehow the nightmare slips under the surface. It's an undercurrent.
Yes, well, it's a subject that you're reluctant, one is reluctant to meet head on because of the danger of what Primo Levi called literary lechery, where you seem to exult in the horror.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Martin Amis about his book, The Zone of Interest. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Martin Amis about his new book, The Zone of Interest, published by Knopf, a story of love in a place that is meant to crush the soul. And it's a very, it's a novel beset by necessary oppositions. You comment that of the survivors, very few seek revenge, but none are willing to forgive.
Only Shimon Wiesenthal, the Nazi hunter, he started agitating for revenge while he was still recovering in hospital after the liberation. I mean, there was never any doubt in his mind that he wanted revenge. But the witnesses, who are extraordinary examples of humanity, they weren't subhumans, as the Nazis thought. They were, in fact, the cream of mankind. And I'm sure that helped them survive. It's how surprising do we find this, that a rich sensibility, which is what they reveal in their testimony, was a help and not a hindrance. You'd think you wanted to be robotic and just shoulder your way through it and give up all your values, but the witnesses say again and again that those who gave up their decency, no matter how fiercely they struggled, nearly always succumbed. You had to have strength of soul and integrity to get through it.
And luck.
And luck.
Yes.
An indoor job, talent for inconspicuousness, the thing that Solzhenitsyn talks about repeatedly in the Gulag Archipelago, a constant cherishing of the sense of your own innocence.
Situate for me, of late, people speaking of more recent adventures in ethnic cleansing in the former Yugoslavia, say, or the horrific events of the Gulag, or the murders in South America, say that by now the Nazi Holocaust, while not exactly small potatoes, is the tone of our times. What do you say?
Oh, I think it is and will continue to be.
I do
eternally.
Too.
Eternally. What I don't believe is that human beings are basically worthless and raring to be monstrous. I don't believe that. And in fact, as Steven Pinker showed in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, the world, despite everything you think and see to the contrary, the world is getting dramatically less violent. And the reasons he gives for that are invention of printing made a big dent in it, the emergence of the state in the early 19th century, Leviathan, which takes upon itself the monopoly of violence, a condition that America neglected to perform, the rise of women, and this is right across the board with, you know, treatment of straights and gays and children and animals. And the other reason he gives, funnily enough, is the rise of the novel, because it's suddenly a reader, you know, in the 18th century was in the shoes of Clarissa Harlowe or Tom Jones or Sophie Weston, occupying another consciousness. And he doesn't like the word empathy, but, you know, imaginative sympathy was what the novel imbued. And I was, of course, very gratified to see that, because I think violence is the great curse of our species and of our sex, male violence. And to be able to think even for an instant that you are contributing to the amelioration of violence is a thrilling idea.
You dedicate the book on its very closing page to those who survived and those who did not, to the memory of Primo Levi, 1919 to 1987, and to the memory of the great poet Paul Celan, 1920 to 1970, and to the countless significant Jews and quarter Jews and half Jews in my past and present, particularly my mother-in-law Elizabeth, my younger daughters Fernanda and Cleo, and my wife Isabel Fonseca. It comes as a extraordinary moment as you close this book, because the book has learned to be impersonal and to keep its author off its pages. Mm-hmm. Help me with the dedication.
Well, when I wrote Time's Arrow, my blood had not mingled with Jewish blood. And my wife of the last 20-odd years is half Jewish and by Jewish law, wholly Jewish. And so my daughters, although they're quarter Jewish, technically. And to feel that consanguinity with 4,000 years of history and 4,000 years of persecution made it... I wasn't something I kept consciously thinking of, but it made the experience of writing this book different. I mean, one Jewish grandparent was enough. And the idea of people taking my daughters to this grotesque hellhole is deeply shocking.
Yeah, it's unbearable.
Yes.
And the closer it comes to one, the more unbearable it is. You suggest following a kind of philosophical logic that the reason why there is no why in Auschwitz is because this is essentially not human activity, and humans cannot really understand it.
Well, yes, Primo Levi has the last word on that when he says that this was tremendously liberating for me because I'd been reading about it for a quarter of a century and realized before I started this novel that I had gained in knowledge and not gained a millimeter in penetration. I still couldn't understand what they thought, and no historian can. No historian has claimed to. They all say it's an impenetrable mystery. And Primo Levi writes, you know, the historical causes of this event are incommensurate. And perhaps we should not understand, we must not understand what happened, because to understand is to contain something, to include yourself in it. And he said the Nazi hatred was anti-human, really counter-human. It is a hatred that is not in us, it is outside man. And suddenly the pressure to understand, the pressure to answer the question why, evaporated. And I thought this was pointing to a way in imaginatively.
What happened to me is I would say to myself at a certain point, I don't want to go to sleep having just been reading this book. But then the book would rise to a power of the inexplicably horrible, and my brain would suffer a whiteout or a meltdown, and I would be able to fall asleep and not dream of it because it was too horrible to imagine. Rather an amazing effect.
Yes, well, many people in the camp feared sleep because the nightmares were so terrible. But having been inured to it for a while, the Sonderkommando Führer Schmuel says, I now think nightmares are pathetic because not one of them comes anywhere close to what waking reality has been for me.
I've been talking with Martin Amis, author of The Zone of Interest, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Zone of Interest at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm, when Marilyn Robinson is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.